Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
26th day of April 2022, allegedly according to that thing we call a calendar, and this indeed is the show you were looking for. How do I know this? Because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, it is Tuesday, Tuesday, the second broadcast day of the week for the O'Shelly Effect. But as for the network, who knows what the hell's going to happen. Anyway, hope you guys are enjoying this. Now, in our normal second hour slot, we're going to have Christy Aphrodite, and we're going to discuss natural solutions to things that you might be able to find, you know, right under your feet and all that. And if you haven't been listening to that series, well, I suggest you go back in the archive while I'm able to keep it up. Because the archives are, that's a lot of storage, okay? And it costs money. And so at the top of the show, I'm just going to mention that I've been cutting down on the archive. And if you're complaining about it, the reason why you're complaining about it is because I don't have the support to maintain it. So if you want it maintained, support the show. Sorry to do that to my first hour guest, because I'm kind of hoping he reposts it over on his great website, CorbettReport.com. Why? Because he's just one of the best. James Corbett, one of my very first guests, one of the guys that I was listening to before I started doing this, one of the guys who inspired me to do this. Enough out of my mouth, I've already killed a minute and a half for no reason, except to tell you that you need to support independent media. Okay. If you want it to remain independent, that is. James, right out of the gate, I want to talk to you about a classic Corbett piece that you have front page on your website right now, CorbettReport.com. Of course, if you don't know who James Corbett is, I don't know how it is you found your way to a radio, a podcast, or a computer, because if you're somebody who is listening to me, you have to know who James Corbett is. How you doing tonight, sir?
I am doing fantastic. Thanks for having me back on.
It's always a pleasure. You know, I've been pleased to be a guest on your show and been really happy that you've been friendly to coming on here, because I'm not as eloquent as you. And I really feel almost like badly after I listen to you speak, because everything is so coherent, so concise, so well-researched, open source intelligence over at CorbettReport.com. Okay, I'm done with the plugs. James, let's start off with that classic piece that I referenced. Stockholm Syndrome, you know, almost sounds like a rap lyric, but it's not. And given my age, I just turned 50, by the way, James, not too long ago. You know, I do recall that there was somebody in the 1970s, and I remember that phrase having emerged first in the nomenclature, if you will, of the time back then. You, as always, give a history and everything else, and there's a video presentation right there, if you go and land on CorbettReport.com. It's not new, though, folks. This is something, almost 10 years old now, I think, back when I was just a listener of yours, James. might have been a guest by then of yours, but I didn't have my own show. I was just about to start my show, I think, when you put this thing out. And again, part of the inspiration and push. So honestly, it was great to see it back out there and pushed to the forward, but you've always kept things as available as you could. So, enough again out of me. If somebody hasn't been to your website lately, tell them what that is, this Stockholm Syndrome presentation you got there.
All right. Well, as you mentioned, it was a podcast that I released going on a decade ago that was examining the psychological phenomenon of Stockholm Syndrome, and I'm sure everyone's heard of it, but people may not know when or how that came to be coined. It was basically the result of a bank robbery that took place in Stockholm, Sweden in 1973, when a convict who was on parole raided a bank, took four of the employees of the bank, three women and one man, hostage, and kept them captive for 6 days while the release was negotiated. And when the hostages were eventually released, none of them would actually testify against their captor in court. Instead, they not only refused to testify, they actually began raising money for his defense, which seems a bit strange, doesn't it? Someone holds you captive at gunpoint for 6 days, you think you might not feel friendly towards them. But this is a well-documented phenomenon. It has happened many times. People who are taken hostage in certain situations, given certain criteria, actually, there is a good chance that they will start to, if not fall in love romantically, at least form some sort of bond with their captor. Mm-hmm. And so I was basically springboarding off of that, which, again, is in parlance. I'm sure everyone's heard of Stockholm Syndrome, is vaguely familiar with the concept. But I was using that as a way of examining the ways that people are kept essentially captive by the people who presume to rule over them and the authorities that presume to keep them safe. Mm-hmm. That is one of the key parts of the Stockholm Syndrome phenomenon, is that when certain criteria are met, for example, the captors feel that they the captives feel that their captor has kept them safe, or didn't kill them, spared their life, or something along those lines. Those acts are interpreted as kindness.
Well, and also, James, some psychological literature, states or posits the concept that this is a survival mechanism, indeed, that if you can find common ground with an aggressive captor, that this might create a situation where you're attempting to survive along with them. And all that. And I mean, there are various machinations about this. I recall it. Now, I was only 1 year old in 1973, but I recall this being mentioned about the Patty Hearst thing, and some other cases where indeed this phenomena is a real thing, although it may sound crazy to the casual observer. So that's interesting in and of itself, but I think where you're about to go is even more relevant, which, quite frankly, is the almost unrecognized, undiagnosed, if you will, element of statism, where, quite honestly, one of the aspects of it is to begin to identify, to call it yours, to call this authority figure one way or another, no matter how connected or disconnected they are indeed in reality or seemingly symbolically or projected to someone through propaganda, media, etc. It's kind of relevant that people side with something that does them no favors, really. And is it a mechanism of survival? Is it just a part of the human condition? I guess these are open questions, but this is the direction you're about to go in, so please continue.
Am I allowed to continue talking this time, or are you going to interrupt me again?
I'm sorry. I felt like throwing that in because I thought you were going to go straight to the big point, and I wanted to just give that little bit of context. My apologies.
All right. Well, I don't know. I was kind of in the middle of saying something, so I don't know where I was now. Maybe you can ask a question.
Okay. So, point is that where you're going with this is the concept that someone who does hold someone captive, just in the theoretical sense, right? This relationship, this bond forms, and it is one of these things that, again, has been sort of debated among psychological scholars, among casual observers, etc. But it's extremely relevant on a mass scale at this point in time. And there is a reason for that, because we have been inundated now with a whole bunch of, well, you know, things to be afraid of. Like, often there have been stories about cult leaders who have held people captive and told them about enemies who are outside of the cult. Now, those enemies may be real, they may not be, but either way, they have used that sort of mechanism to hold someone captive, right? And I think where you're going here is that on a mass scale, this has been done quite effectively. Without having to hold someone physically captive, they have done this on a psychological level to the general public. Would you say that that's true?
Yes. In fact, that was kind of the point of the podcast.
Yes. Well, no, but it's a great point. But now how do we take this 2013 or 2012 or whenever it was that you actually put it together? Somebody might say, well, James, you know, the condition must have changed. People obviously have learned, they become more well-informed, but it doesn't seem that way at all. Actually, it seems as though it's been perfected. Its accuracy, its efficacy, if you will, has been increased over the past decade, as opposed to people becoming more well-informed and independent-minded. Or maybe I'm wrong about this. What do you think?
Well, I think this is an incredibly important phenomenon to look at from today's perspective, and I think it has been made even more apparent over the past 2 years of psychological manipulations of the public, the ways that these techniques can be used to make people essentially love their captors. In this case, we see the literal votary candles and other such things being lit to the gurus of the biosecurity state, like Anthony Fauci, who are now venerated by that portion of the population which has been subjected to this psychological maneuver. And I think to a certain extent, this is an organic phenomenon, but I think more cynically, it has been manipulated to be this way. And so I think the real question for us in 2022 is not just to identify this phenomenon. I certainly wasn't the first to do it. I think it's been pointed out many times before. The real point is to figure out how to break that spell. And that is something that I'm increasingly turning my attention to as this phenomenon pervades the public psychology to an extent that is, I would say, if not unprecedented, at least unprecedented within our times. I don't think we've seen this level of manipulation and gaslighting of the population taking place in living memory.
Right. Now, it's interesting to me because, again, those that would think that the public would be more well-informed, given there are people like you out there, there's been a proliferation of individuals who have very soberly explained exactly how you're being manipulated on a mass scale. They've explained the history of it. They've talked to us about Bernays, and they've talked to us about let's be frank, the sort of Madison Avenue version of the grand psyop. They talk about all these things, and yet there is a limited discussion about what do you do outside of, yes, think for yourself, but it's that simple, but then again, not that simple, it seems. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I think you hit on it earlier when you said that what is actually taking place in this phenomenon is, in a sense, a sort of cognitive self-defense mechanism that people, whether consciously or more likely subconsciously, understand that their safety, their continued existence depends on them essentially pleasing their captor so that they decide that they don't get eliminated in that situation. And if that is the case, and if we extrapolate that to the sort of societal phenomenon that we see taking place, then the point would be, people, to a certain extent, feel that their existence, or at least their comfortable existence, is threatened by the prospect of the powers that, say, a Fauci or some other person in position of power has over them, over their lives, over their ability to provide for their families, for example. And so we must please our captors. We must do what they say. We must vote for them and be their biggest boosters, right? In order to overcome that, then, we have to essentially make it safe for people to defy their would-be overlords. And that really hinges upon what I think this all continually goes back to, which is the creation of communities of interest, of like-minded people who are able to, in some sense, provide and take care for each other, rather than having to rely on the greater state and its machinations for their livelihood. And so I think it continues to come back to this, in sort of all paths seem to lead back to this point. Until we are able to start creating and fostering communities of interest, I don't think we'll be able to provide that safety, which will allow the people who have been under Stockholm syndrome to really escape that phenomenon.
Well, right, but then one might argue that there is the other weapon, which is in and of itself a creature, because let's just say somebody doesn't necessarily take Fauci to be the overlord here, although a lot of people seem to. They might simply buy into the overall narrative, which has generally been injected into the consciousness, where they have questions. They don't necessarily agree with what's being done, but out of fear alone, again, I mean, I hate to go to this, but over the virus itself, right, where they have now bought into it enough that it's not one particular figure that's holding them captive, but it is an idea. So there is that element of it. Would you separate that from the overall kind of cult of personality thing where there's the appeal to an authority that is manifest in an individual or a group? Or would you say that these are two separate things, or are they... Well, they do commingle, obviously, but, I mean, are they separate?
They do commingle, but in a specific way. And I believe that it is the case that a lot of people are actually uncomfortable with the various restrictions that have been placed on them, but are unwilling to express that discomfort unless and until they have social validation that there will be a safe way to for them to express that. That was put in crystal clear on the television of the mass viewing audiences just a couple of months ago when Saturday Night Live addressed this in a sketch, which is fascinating to watch from a psychological perspective. The sketch took the form of a dinner party between some friends who were meeting, and it was presumably their first sort of in-person meeting in a long time because of the COVID scandemic. So they were all sort of dancing around all of the things that they can and cannot say about what has just taken place and their comfort or discomfort with people who are maskless or against the vaccines, etc. And if you watch that skit from the perspective of what is it safe for the sort of the mainstream Democrat people who would essentially be on board with the pronouncements of the various medical authorities and what they're saying. If you watch it from the perspective of, well, then what are they allowed to express about their discomfort with what has just taken place? And that really was the entire humor of the sketch. People saying that, well, you know, actually, I mean, masks don't really do anything. Oh, you can't say that. That was the entire premise of the sketch, which I think is actually the heart of this phenomenon. Everyone, or if not everyone, at least the vast majority of people are uncomfortable with the excesses and overreach that has just taken place, but they feel unable to even express that. And I think that is expressly because of the Stockholm Syndrome. And I think you're right, it's not about any particular one person, although it is generally, it gravitates towards one person. In the U.S. context, it gravitates towards someone like a Fauci, but they're not the person in control of this. They simply become the figurehead who, if he came out tomorrow and said, yeah, you know what, masks are useless, I think there would be a collective sigh of relief, which is exactly what we saw in those videos that went viral of the captain announcing in mid-flight, oh, by the way, they've just dropped the mask mandate for flights, and everyone spontaneously cheered. I think that is the sense. Most people are actually not on board with this. They have only gone along with it because they feel their captors won't allow them to express disapproval.
Yeah, but also the captors are not, again, just in the halls of power because, frankly, the enforcers are people all around you. I mean, there are individuals. Now, I live in Georgia, so it was not an intense thing, but I heard over and over again and saw over and over again that people all over this country, anyway, certainly had different levels of kind of being shamed, which I found interesting, especially because they were leftists sort of shaming people into a behavior pattern, which I found a bit contradictory to the projected ethical standards of the people that identify themselves that way. But I saw that, and I also see that it's on a local level that you get kind of pushed into this, and how dare you, and you get lectured, and you get told, you know, you're endangering others. This kind of thing, that level of enforcement doesn't just come from the top. So it is a collective sort of Stockholm syndrome, whereas a someone who is a singular captor, a hostage, say, and even in the Iran hostage situation, other hostage situations where I've read the accounts, there is some level of this that simply does occur. So I think, I mean, I'm just guessing here, but I think this may be a lot more of a common phenomenon than people wish to accept. And they certainly don't want to accept that they might be being held hostage by the powers that be, by the regulation, by the social pressure. I mean, it almost sounds like I'm trying to dance around the concept of peer pressure, right? But who are your actual peers? That's an important element of this as well, is it not?
There are a couple of different strands that are, I think, pertinent to what you've just mentioned. One of which is that who are our peers actually is something that in our increasingly mediated reality is essentially dictated to us by the media, which presumes to dictate what reality is for us. And I mean that in the sense that For example, a very common type of story that you will see on the news is a report about a poll. And this poll has found that 77% of people believe this and 14% believe that. But there's only a few percent, you know, the fringe minority who believe that other thing. And we tend to internalize those stories as if that is some form of valid news, rather than an attempt to shape our opinion about a subject by showing us this is what your peers think and this is what you should believe. And that's done in, as I say, very blatant ways in reporting on polls, for example, but in more subtle ways as well, that simply reflecting certain types of viewpoints in the media and completely ignoring others does send the psychological signal on a subconscious level, for the most part, that we are to believe this. And if we do not believe this, or at least somewhere in the ballpark of this, then we are so far outside of the mainstream discourse that we will be completely excluded from it, which, of course, signifies a type of social death, which is our entire human programming, I think, is to try to avoid that. So I think media plays an incredibly important part of that. The other part of this, and the reason, in fact, why I posted this particular nearly 10-year-old podcast to the front page, is because it's very much in line with what I've been thinking about recently and wrote about in my most recent editorial called The Greatest Trick of All. I'm wondering if you saw or read through that one yet.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. Yeah. I looked at that. I also checked out, you know, New World next week, which I always do with you and James Pilato. A lot of great stuff comes out, but yeah, go ahead and talk about this, The Greatest Trick, because, again, it leads directly into where we could take this next. James, go ahead.
Yes. So what this editorial is about is about essentially that formation of the acceptable opinion and how that is done on a mass scale. And I liken it to a magic trick in this editorial, the magic, of course, being able to making you believe something that isn't true, perceive something that doesn't exist, something along those lines. And unfortunately, the people who would seek to control society by controlling public opinion have had, at the very least, documentably, a century of hard scientific study into the process of making people believe things. And in that vein, I think a perfect example is what we are seeing right now with regards to the Switch Off Putin campaign, which is being forwarded. It's a report that has been put forward by essentially three people who I think would call themselves environmental activists of a sort, but I certainly do question that if you look into those characters and their history. But at any rate, it is getting all sorts of mainstream media coverage because, of course, it hits on all the right propaganda buttons. But the long and short of it is this report purports to explain how Europe could completely 100% boycott Putin, i.e. gas and oil coming from Russia. And how could Europe do that? It relies for so much of its energy on Russian gas. Well, here's how we can do it. We can do all of the exact same things that the so-called big oil-led environmental movement has been arguing for at least half a century now, which is essentially the creation of a neo-feudal peasant society where you scrabble to eke out a living from the soil, like in medieval peasants. Yay. And so my point here is that it is a sort of magic trick to take something that is inherently against the interests of a people, but to sell it to them, to spin it, to essentially misdirect them into believing that this is what you want. You should be demanding this thing that is in fact against your interests. And it is a scary thing to watch that taking hold of the populace, but it is. And as one example of that, I do cite the polling, which of course the Switch Off Putin campaign itself actually commissioned. So take it for what it's worth. But again, speaking of controlling people through polling, but now they're saying just over 40% of people polled in Europe for this report said they would be prepared to accept energy rationing to manage demand, and 52.7% said that they would eat less meat to reduce demand on Ukrainian exports. So you see, it all comes back to eating bugs and drinking rainwater and living off the land and having certainly none of the creature comforts you're used to in the name of, what is it? Saving Mother Earth? No, that doesn't work.
No.
Stopping pandemics? No, that people aren't going for that. Oh, I know. Getting Putin. That's what it's about, I tell you.
No, I get that. And look, I have no objection if somebody wants to eat bugs and live off the land. That's fine. You know, I think...
The funniest thing is every single time I bring this up, I will always get someone saying, what's wrong with eating bugs? And rainwater is fine. Why collect rainwater? Are you against that? I think, and like, how can people be so obtuse that they miss the point on this?
Oh, no, of course. I get the point, but I'm just saying that, like, I have no objections to those things, but it is interesting that is the point at which somebody would concede, right? You know, as you said, it's like, oh, it's not for this purpose, it's not for that purpose, it's not for, well, possibly, you know, there's cruelty. Like, I have no objections to people who don't eat meat. I still eat meat. You know, if this is what you are ethically comfortable with, by all means, long as you don't harm someone else, you know, the non-aggression concept. I mean, that's all I care about. But frankly, the idea that people are willing to sacrifice in order to further whatever the agenda is here is really strange, considering you could tell them the planet's on fire, that's fine, doesn't matter, I'm still going to keep my stuff. You could tell them a lot of different things, it doesn't matter, I still want to keep my stuff. You know, but here is the line. I do find that interesting as well. So that is the point that you were making, is that here is the line they drew that they would step over. And it's fascinating because there are, of course, many American polls that go along with this. I'm being asked from the chat room, by the way, if you have any views on the fact that Trudeau appears to have survived a vote, considering that you're Canadian, in origin anyway, currently living in Japan. But if you have any views on that, and, you know, by all means, go ahead, because that might tie very well into this as well.
Well, not only as a Canadian who has been living in Japan for going on 2 decades now, but also an anarchist, I really couldn't care less about the political fortunes of Justin Trudeau.
Okay.
But at any rate, I don't find it particularly surprising, because unfortunately, if Stockholm Syndrome applies on a societal level to any population, I would say it applies to the Canadian population, perhaps more so than a lot of other nationalities around the globe. Why is that? I'm not exactly sure, but unfortunately, the Canadian public tends to be extremely credulous, which is why the Freedom Convoy was such an important thing to be happening in Canada, of all places, I think was an important phenomenon at that time. That it has not translated into the political movement that will topple a Justin Trudeau does not particularly surprise me. But at any rate, at the very least, it revealed the dictator for what he is, and I think more people can see through that now. I don't expect that to translate into some sort of political victory, but I don't think the fundamental victory here is going to be political in nature anyway.
No, I think that's the point overall, is that we are literally, and I don't want to borrow a phrase from somebody you and I both know, but there is a psychological war here for people's minds that is fully engaged. And the politics will come and go. The politicians will certainly come and go. As for when they decide to send out a sacrificial lamb and allow them to be, you know, found to be as corrupt as they are every now and then, you know, in public. But it's not going to change this relative trend, which has been building for a long time. So again, the appeal to authority and all of this happening, and the concept that people are held captive, and they're also having these enforcers on the local level in their direct vicinity. This is the phenomena that we need to confront. So again, outside of educating oneself, because I've actually had conversations with people who are fully educated on, say, we'll just go with the vaccine for the moment. I know that vaccines have been problematic. I know that this thing, this and that, and the third thing, and they've got a lot of logical points of resistance. And at the end of the conversation, they tell you, but I took it anyway. And you say, okay, why? You had all these objections, and they just were looking at it and saying, because of all of the general sort of noise or static out there that made them believe that they might be in danger or they could be endangering somebody else, compliance was given. It's the same thing with the mask. I'm not into wearing the mask. I wore it for a little while, to be honest with you, because it just became too difficult to go into public or interact with other people who were petrified of being around somebody without a mask on. That's changed, and it changed rather rapidly. Again, it's a regional concern. I'm sure everybody's experiences have varied, but this idea that some level of compliance is mined even out of somebody like me, who is generally, well, just automatically resistant to the authorities to begin with, okay? You know, again, I don't call myself an anarchist. I seem to be getting closer and closer to that, though, as things evolve and as I find that the systems have failed well beyond their failure rate I was able to embrace only a decade ago. You know, the more I discover, the more I discover how these things don't work. And the more I discover, it's just, you know, government is literally the threat of violence. That's all there is to it anymore. And could we do it differently? Sure we could, at any moment. But if you have all these other people who will fall into line because this is the way to go, I mean, you can't even get them to not allow an injection to go into their bodies when they have reasonable intellectual and spiritual questions about it. How are you going to even get them to confront the idea that maybe the power structure should not be as it is? And you need to go outside of it entirely in order to achieve something called freedom. How do you even get there? You know, it's quite a bridge, isn't it?
Well, it certainly is. Yes. Yes. I don't know what point you want me to elaborate on there, but I agree.
Well, okay, fair enough. But what do we do again? What is your suggestion for somebody to begin to deprogram themselves? Because they have indeed been programmed one way or another over time, different ways, different facilities, different institutions have programmed things in order so that this is the logical way to, well, survive in the captive situation. Comply with your captors. How do you get them to recognize that they're captives? And how do you get them to recognize that they've actually done this as a matter of survival, and perhaps without any sort of pressure or choice, they might choose differently? I mean, where do you even begin that conversation, James?
Excellent question, because the real point of the question is how you have the conversation itself. And that is ultimately the crux of it, because I don't feel it's incumbent on me to save anyone or to do anything to rescue someone from some situation. It has to come from a natural impetus of the person themselves, an inclination on their part to do something to save themselves. I think the real point is towards the first part of the question, which is, how do we even convince people that they are captors? How do we show them that this is happening? And I think that's really the root of this. I don't think there's a magic bullet that this is the way to present the information that people will instantly understand. I don't believe that exists, because, of course, everyone has their own ways of processing and understanding this information. But even more to the point, I think there are a lot of people who simply do not want to understand the situation in that context, in that way, because of course it does then prompt them to ask the question, well, what do I do about this? How do I change my life according to this new understanding and insight that I have? And most people really don't want to do that. So if we make it about ourselves and we have to find the right way to introduce this so that people will understand it, then unfortunately that really just sets ourselves up for a lot of failure and a lot of frustration. And it will, I mean, unless you're a particularly perseverant person, it will probably result in you giving up on the entire enterprise after some amount of time. Really what I attempt to do is try to articulate this in ways that will hopefully resonate with people so that they will be able to see what is happening. And that's why, for example, I looked at Stockholm Syndrome as one way of framing this in a way that people could see this situation in a different light, or why I talk about the greatest trick of all. And I start talking about magic tricks and techniques of misdirection, because that's another way that we can understand the psychological campaign that's being waged against us. Or it's why I talk about, for example, World War III has already begun. It is a war of governments against their own people, and we are the victims of it, and everyone is at war. That's why I've talked about fifth generation warfare. These are all different ways of attempting to articulate essentially the same insight. And I know that different ways will resonate with different people at different times, but only if they are receptive to it, only if they are willing to actually take a look at it. And it's certainly not my duty or your duty or anyone else's duty to make someone else understand something. All you can do is present it to them. And if it resonates with them, it resonates with them. And we can never tell what will go viral and what will be the video or the thing, the article, whatever, that millions of people will resonate with and they'll all get on board. Who knows? That's why you just have to keep throwing darts at the dartboard. As to what we then do with this, I really think that the fundamental point is simply to realize this is a magic show. This is Stockholm Syndrome. This is propaganda. This is World War III. This is what this is. And once we realize that, I think the solutions then manifest organically from different people working together on through a shared understanding. And I'm not going to be here to dictate that for anyone, because different people will want to do that in different ways. And there's nothing, I mean, it's not like I am going to come out with a solution to all of this. That's not the point of it. I think the point is to get people on board with understanding, the shared understanding of what is happening to them, and let them deal with the consequences of that as they will. I know that's not a satisfying answer, but that's the only real one.
But a fair one. And the other thing is, though, I know you said, look, it's not your duty, it's not my duty to encourage people to get to a certain point or to, you know, to teach them directly about... I get all
no,
that.
It is. It could be our duty, or at least our calling, to encourage or to teach.
Okay.
But it is not our duty to make someone understand something, or to admit something. Let's put it that way. Because once you present it to someone and teach someone and spend your time and effort articulating something, it is then up to them to make the mental transformation. That is not something that we can take on as our responsibility.
Well, no, but precisely. Okay, no, I'm glad you clarified that, because I must have misunderstood. But, you know, great point, by the way. The thing is, I do feel obligated, though, to step in on one particular aspect here, which is part of that greater watch my left hand while my right hand is actually doing the deed, right? And it's all about the divide and conquer strategy, which has been extremely effective. They have us arguing with one another all too often, as opposed to arguing with the circumstance, the situation, the bureaucracy, the actual powers that be, even if you even have an idea who they are half the time, and choosing sides. I'll give you a great, for instance, right now, the great debate about Elon Musk and the wondrous thing that's about to happen because he's taken over Twitter, of all things, James. I mean... You know, well, I'm all for Musk. Well, I'm against him. Well, yeah, again, another shiny thing that they're telling you to either run to or run away from. And you're choosing a side and forgetting that, you know, you didn't pick the menu or the sides. Somebody else designed that, and now you're being herded into it. And that's a minor issue, mind you. Which, by the way, I wonder if you saw the news that Abraham Bolden got pardoned by the Biden administration. Did you see that?
That name doesn't even ring a bell to me.
Abraham Bolden was the Secret Service agent, the first black Secret Service agent who Kennedy brought in on his presidential protection team. And he was when he was about ready to go testify to the Warren Commission, suddenly he was taken down on a trumped up counterfeiting charge. And has been seeking a pardon now through at least, I don't know, the past four presidents. For, you know, he's out of prison and everything. But he was certainly framed, yeah. Why now? Well, for years people have been asking. I've signed I don't know how many petitions. We've tried to campaign for this through different presidents, although I must admit I did not make any attempt with Trump because I saw absolutely no reason to. But he was somebody who was framed. If you ever heard of a book called Echoes from Dealey Plaza, tells the story about the Chicago plot and all that, which I know you have heard of.
Yeah.
So no, Abraham Bolden. But I thought you might be interested in that. But that's okay. Side issue. But think about this: the debates over Musk and what he's going to do for people, and the grand debate about Trump and what he was going to do for people. You know, oh, he's going to reveal all the JFK stuff. He didn't. Then Biden came in. He didn't. It doesn't matter what the issue is. People believe something because they've been directed to take a side based on. And that's the thing that I think is the most poisonous. And I do feel obligated at all times to explain to people that, You're being given a side, you're being given a choice, and it's all based on false premises. This is a waste of time and a great distraction to where your energies and your efforts could go. And this is how we're going to go back into the topic again. Fact is that if you're distracted by that, your time is taken up by that, your resources, maybe you're paying into things, maybe you're participating in things, instead of doing something productive, you're basically rooting for, well, one of the wrestlers on the WWE stage, which at the end of the day, Vince McMahon decides who gets paid anyway, and they all get a paycheck from the same corporation. So, you know, who are you rooting for? What are you rooting for? Why are you spending time on that instead of learning about what it is we're talking about, the amount of control that is being lorded over oneself? I see, this is where I feel obligated, is to at least reveal that you're being misdirected, you're being turned against each other instead of your real and true enemy. No matter who you think that is, you're still being misdirected. What do you think about that as a key issue in this discussion we're having here? And is that not really the like I said, I'm compelled all the time, whether it's somebody talking to me, you know, while I'm getting a cup of coffee at a gas station, or they're on this show, I always feel a need to say, oh, hold on, think about the energy and time you're putting into that, as opposed to really looking at what's holding you back, what's actually causing conditions in your life to be the way they are that you're complaining about. Don't root for a politician. Don't root for a corporatist master to come in and change the equation. Change it. Think about it for yourself. And stop just rooting for the saviors one way or another to come along and help you. What about that? Because I feel as though this ties directly into the whole concept of massive Stockholm syndrome. What do you think?
Well, in fact, I see the parallel quite directly with the magic trick metaphor, in attentional misdirection being a key part of most of the magical techniques, is about getting the audience to focus on something so that they do not see what is happening in the other, in the magician's other hand. And I think that is an incredibly important part of this, which is why, for example, let's take the Musk distraction as a example par excellence. If they, could get me, someone like myself, spending a second of my time or two of my neurons actually thinking about or caring about Twitter, then they have won. Because I do not care about Twitter at all. It could vanish off the face of the planet tomorrow, and I wouldn't even notice, let alone care. So why would I spend my time, my valuable time, energy, attention, resources, whatever, towards even caring about what Musk is or is not going to do on Twitter? That is completely misdirecting my energy, my attention, what I have to bring to this world. And so I think that's actually a perfect example of how this can operate. They always set not just the terms of the debate, but the debate itself. You may talk about Twitter and Elon Musk, and look, you can have this hot take or that hot take or that hot take, but don't talk about something else. I mean, when it is time to talk about Will Smith slapping Chris Rock, everyone must have a take on it. And it doesn't matter if your take is the conspiratorial take. Oh, yeah, well, you know, the Oscars were sponsored by Pfizer, and thus it was a big Pfizer false flag setup, or whatever your take on it is. As long as you're talking about it, they win. That's really the point of this, and that's something that my work keeps coming back to.
Well, it has to, because this is a constant look, what's the old expression? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. They have effectively used this to keep people constantly engaged. And I mean, I'm seeing it today with this situation with the, you know, Twitter. And the big question for me as I'm observing it is, you know, these people saying, oh, we have this guy who's in control of this essential platform. And I'm not sitting there wanting to side with or against him. I asked the question of somebody, well, why is this an essential platform? You guys are talking about this like it's, you know, your water supply, which you don't pay any attention to. Okay? In America,
yeah,
they don't.
Exactly.
Literally, like, if you go to any place in America, you test the water and you tell them what's in their water, they'll be shocked. Because even if they mail them the results of what their own water tests, which I'm not saying you need to entirely trust, sometimes the stuff that's in there would scare the crap out of people if they ever bothered to read it. Yep. In the local water supply, James.
Which they don't. And if they did, they would promptly forget and ignore it. Well, you're exactly right. Yeah, that's a good example of it, in fact. Well, because, yes, because that's exactly the point, is that the whatever side, whatever take you have on something like the Musk situation, it starts from that fundamental principle, which is just taken as a given, that Twitter is the public square. It is essential. This is essential part of the functioning of the human species. And if I reject that fundamental principle, I have no part to play in this debate. I don't care. You guys go debate it amongst yourselves. I have nothing to say about this because I reject that at its core, which you're not allowed to do from within the logic of the debate that is handed toward to you in situations like this.
Now, see, the reverse of that, which also applies, though, is the whole thing about Bitcoin and NFTs, right? Where if you're somebody like me who is still skeptical of all that, even though I'm getting an idea about the blockchain and I get the idea of, you know, of course, I'm not in line with let's just let the central banks handle it. No, but the idea is that it's still something that I can't wrap my hands around. Okay, so to me, it is suspect. Now, I say that, and it's blasphemy to some people in independent media, all, you know, whatever, I don't even know what to call it anymore. People that don't want to fall in line with the corporate media. Okay, let's just put it that way, in their own special ways, sometimes not so special ways. And they get angry and tell you, well, how dare you? This is the thing you need to invest in. And then I see somebody like Peter Thiel making some very interesting statements about it. And, you know, look, red flags got to go up when you see Peter Thiel making statements. If you know the history of this guy, you know the level of, his connection to humanity when it comes to technology, okay? There's a lot to be said here. Is it all great and good, and is it all on our side? Well, you got to pick a side when it comes to Bitcoin. You got to pick a side when it comes to NFTs, which now every corporate entity in the world is starting to use, even Major League Sports in America. You know, you can buy clips of highlights that are supposed to be absolutely yours. You have the NFT on it. You know that? So, you know, where are we going here with this? The thing is, it's the intangible to me. Much like Twitter is an intangible thing. People engage with it, and they somehow start to get accustomed to the idea that that artificial reality, okay, and you know we're going to go to Metaverse in a second, that artificial reality is something to be fought over, is something that they possess somehow because they're engaged in it psychologically. But at the end of the day, brass tacks, what does Twitter do for you? I mean, I don't mean you, James. What does Twitter do for you? What do any of these virtual things that you're plugged into that are intangible do for you? You're going to buy your virtual baseball cards and collect them? Okay, fine. No problem there. Your virtual books, which I still object to, get a paper book, okay? But either way, it's this idea that people connect into the intangible to such a degree that, you know, they used to be able to sell you cheap crap that wasn't worth much for a lot more than it was worth. Now they can sell you nothing except an idea that you might have access to as long as they allow it, or a movie or whatever. You know, you have your digital library or all that now. And is that freedom from the greater corporate structure, or is that an even easier and actually more cost-effective way for the intellectual slavery to be enforced, right? So why am I asking this question? Because, again, people are so engaged in intangible things, they don't pay attention to something that is very real, very direct, like the water supply. Like, have you looked over your head today and seen what they're spraying over your head? Do you know what's on the ground when you're walking around? Do you have any idea what's in the food you eat? No, let me talk about the content of Twitter and how the metaverse is going to work when you're not managing the world around you. I mean, how do you get more of a direct plug into the Matrix without sticking something into the back of your head, James? Seriously, I mean, What are your thoughts there about the intangible versus the tangible? And obviously, I'm not saying bashing any of this stuff. I say if you can sell an idea and people are happy to buy it, do it all day. I believe in the free market. But at the same time, people that are so engaged with that and appear to be so invested in that psychologically, emotionally, is that at the root of, well, the lever of control that they can exert and leverage upon people to keep them in this state of Stockholm syndrome?
In a word, yes. But unfortunately, I think the problem goes so much deeper into the roots of the problem that we face that it's almost overwhelming to think about. Because what you're really talking about is the difference between direct experiential reality and mediated reality. And if we even just take a moment to think about the amount of time and space and energy that we spend in mediated reality as opposed to experiential reality, it's really quite overwhelming at this point. I'm not just talking about spending time in front of a screen on the internet. I mean reading something in a book. That is mediated reality as well. And it has so pervaded our experience of the world that I really ask this as a mental exercise for people out there. Just contemplate how much of your knowledge of the world comes from actual direct experience versus how much you've read about in books. And so, for example, take the news story of the moment, what's happening in Ukraine. I've never even been to Ukraine, let alone not on the ground at the moment, you know, in there actually experiencing what is happening in the country, right? So literally every single thing that I know about Ukraine and its history and everything related to it is from mediated reality. And this is why I spent a couple of months last year teaching an online course about the history of online media and why I will be pursuing that this year. Because honestly, I think this is probably one of the most foundational, fundamental things that is often left unaddressed because so few people even think about it in our day and age. But it leads, with a sort of inexorable logic, to essentially the Matrix, aka the metaverse. People are going to literally be starting to plug themselves into that mediated reality so that then their experiential reality actually is mediated reality, which starts to, I mean, that really starts to, how can I put this? I don't know the radio broadcast safe word for it. Intercourse with your mind, I guess.
fair enough.
It's absolutely overwhelming to think about. And we are right on the cusp of that, which actually I think is probably when we start plugging ourselves into that virtual matrix in the literal sense of literally strapping on the goggles and going into mediated reality, I think that's the point at which we actually start to lose our humanity. And I think this entire struggle, everything that we face against the powers that shouldn't be, is essentially a struggle to retain our humanity in the face of this type of mechanization of existence that's coming into view. And I wish it was as simple as simply rejecting the technology. But if people read something like Neil Postman's work on Amusing Ourselves to Death, he does address the sort of neo-Luddite approach towards the end of the book. And I think roundly and accurately dismisses it as, well, that's probably not going to be an effective way. It's never worked before in history, and there's no sign it will work with the current technologies. So I think we need a more thoroughgoing response to this, but unfortunately few people even think to know how to articulate this problem or even see the problem, let alone actually address it properly.
Right. I mean, outside of joining an Amish community and a few others on the planet, I mean, what are you going to do at this point? It seems as though even if you attempt to personally evade the technological sphere of influence that is, it will touch upon you if you interact with anyone effectively. So, I mean, it's actually better than a virus, isn't it? Okay. I'll leave it at that. James, what is coming up on CorbettReport.com that you could tell people about? I mean, certainly you're constantly putting out great material, but I want to give you a few minutes to let people have a little heads up. I know you're always working on stuff. Some things are longer term projects than others, and really, really pleased and grateful that you took the time out to talk to me today. But I know you're a busy guy over there. Tell us what's coming up on CorbettReport.com.
Well, you say I'm constantly putting out stuff, but people for the last few weeks may quibble with that, because as you may or may not have noticed, I am definitely putting out a lot less these days, and that is intentional. Not because I am working less, but because my work is going on more behind the scenes at the moment, as I'm working on several long-term projects, one of which is that aforementioned history of online media. As I say, I did that course last year, and I'm working on adopting that into a series that will hopefully be released in the next couple of months that will really elaborate that and hopefully get people to understand the extremely grave nature of the problem that we're facing. So that is one of those long-term projects. There are some others. For example, people might remember that I last year released the first two parts of my Al-Qaeda documentary. Well, obviously there is a third part on that coming, and other long-term projects that I'm working on. So I'm doing a lot more of that and a lot less of posting on a daily basis right now. As some people have observed, that gives them the chance to catch up on my voluminous 15-year archive with literally thousands upon thousands of hours of media, like the aforementioned Stockholm Syndrome podcast. So I will be posting still a couple of posts a week, but just not the 5, 6, or 7 that I was posting before I took this little reprieve. And I will also be posting flashbacks of older material that people might have missed from the archives. So I hope people will continue to stay tuned to CorbettReport.com. And if they do like the work and want to support it, of course, they can become subscribers. But everything is there for free. I would never suggest someone become a subscriber sight unseen. If you follow the work and you find it valuable, then I do appreciate people's support.
Right, which can be done for as little as $1 a month. Just saying. And look, I'm a subscriber over there. I find your work extremely valuable, always have, you know, from the very beginning when I was listening to it, when it was just sort of a disembodied podcast that I sort of stumbled across one day. And it's always been great stuff. So even if you get some of the classic Corbett that's coming out now, and by the way, the documentaries are always great. I often refer back to your the name of it I forget sometimes, but How Oil Conquered the World, I think it was a great documentary. Also, your work on going all the way back to 2013 now, your work on the Federal Reserve and A Century of Enslavement, I think it was called. Great titles, but not just great titles. The work is very solid, very well done, very well informed. And you know what James does too, which I try to do, but I'm not as good at it, is give you reference links to everything he's talking about, everything he shows you on a video. You know, it's not just there for entertainment purposes, although some of your stuff is very entertaining as well. So appreciate that and appreciate your work. Anything you want to say on your way out the door, James?
No, I think that'll do it for today. Thank you for having me on. Thank you for doing what you do.
Look, I appreciate you, and again, whether you want to own it or not, you're partially the inspiration for this, so I know I'm a lot more obnoxious than you. I think, you know, you mentioned something about Canadians and how credulous they are. It's interesting. You're very calm all the time. I very rarely ever heard you get angry at anything. I did note that you were sort of taking a break, but every time you do, when you take a break, it seems like you come out with one of these really great pieces a little bit after. And yeah, there is a volume of material over there. No matter how you've been following James, you can keep track of at CorbettReport.com. And still the same website, although you might have been deplatformed here or there. Odyssey has your videos, I know, and you also write on Substack, I think, now, right?
I am testing the waters over there. So far, I haven't been censored, so we'll see how that goes. But yeah, CorbettReport.com is obviously the place for people to go, but they can find links to my work on different platforms from there.
Yes, absolutely. And you've been on a lot of platforms that you're no longer on, just saying. So that might be the only point of discussion you want to have about Twitter sometime. But then again, maybe not, because it doesn't really matter. CorbettReport.com. I suggest it. I subscribe. And you should, too. Thank you, James. I really appreciate you taking this hour with me.
All right. Take care, Chuck.
Anyway, guys, stick around. In the next hour, we'll be talking to Christy Aphrodite. James Corbett, CorbettReport.com.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. the stock market, WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
GoChili.com.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words, you'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia.
By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this.
Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961.
Get your copy today at Amazon.com.
Why? The Vietnam War
by author Mike Swanson.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. By Larry Hancock. Secret wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Second hour of the Ocelli Effect continues now at Ocelli.com. Just no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome to the show. It is just after 9 p.m. Eastern on Tuesday, and we're not going to take calls tonight. Okay. So But no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, welcome. Welcome to the show. And if you want to ask questions in the live chat room, go ahead and do that at Ocelli.com. Just click on the Listen Live button. Go there. If not, you can do the same thing at ChristyAphrodite.com. Because coincidentally, Christy Aphrodite is with me. I also have, hopefully will remain my silent co-host with me, is Bonnie the puppy. So, just, you guys can't see at home. I just held her up for no reason. Anyways, so Christy Aphrodite is with me. MyTrueEssence.net. ChristyAphrodite.com. As I mentioned, you could go over there and listen live and be in the chat room as well. It's the same chat room, and it's the same radio stream at Ocelli.com. Anyways, Christy, first off, how you doing tonight?
I'm hanging in there. It just seems like life just keeps getting better and better and busier, and spring is springing, and that makes me happy. You mentioned your silent co-host, and I have a few new additions to the family here too, and so some of my silent co-hosts will also be joining us tonight.
Excellent. Well, hopefully Bonnie remains silent. She does yap now, because everybody knows she was born a couple of months ago.
Right, that's what I'm hoping for yeah. Both of us.
But she, yeah, no, she's here, and Kim added another one too, which I think they were playing out there and making a lot of noise during James Corbett's segment. But so we're gonna try and see if we can make it so that there isn't a problem here during the broadcast. That's why I brought her in the office. Okay. Anyways.
They're pets and they're cute no matter what they do. So if they want to join in on the show and give a little bark or scream or catfight here and there, I'm game.
Okay, so Bonnie, you can speak for yourself if you want. All right. Anyway, so what is the point? We have been doing this series, and I'm really glad that you've done it with me. I want to get right to it. Last week, we started talking about depression. But only started, really, and there's a lot of ground to cover. You know, again, the typical theme about your body and your mind will tell you when something is not going according to its natural design, and that's something you know a little bit about. In the chat room, they're already asking if you have any view on the whole Twitter controversy about Elon Musk or whatever, I guess. But... You know, I don't know how you feel. Yeah.
I don't actually care. I don't understand why everybody's so easily triggered by just, like, who cares? You know, Elon or the NSA or the CIA, or they're all the same thing. I don't know. I don't care. It's a stupid place to go and read funny things sometimes. And, like, I don't know. It's not going to affect me either way. I don't care. Do you care? Like, why am I supposed to care, actually?
No, I'm good. See, there we go with the barking in the other room anyway. All right, anyways, look.
But really, yeah. I don't honestly understand why people are triggered, so do you want to enlighten me? Because, I mean, I'm sure people, the trigger-happy people, you know, maybe they need to listen to the show in depression and anxiety, because if you're that easily triggered by somebody purchasing something, or like, I don't know. I don't understand. So please educate me.
No.
Okay. You're not gonna tell me why I'm supposed to be triggered, damn it.
No, I'm not. I refuse, and I'll tell you why. Because you're not engaged in it, and that's the healthiest way to be. So I'm not going to endanger your health by laying this all out for you. Never mind.
Right. I mean, you know, they're all just cartoon characters, right. And they're all playing a role, you know, characters, actors, whatever you want to. And some of them are funny and some of them aren't so funny. But in my life, at least here at the Ozarks Church of Nature, I don't care who they are or what position or what role they're acting in or whatever. There is nothing they do or say that affects my health and happiness. And obviously, that's not to discount the clear inflation going on, and it is extremely severe and such, but I mean, anyone that's listening to your show, Chuck, they saw all that coming anyways and were already prepared or changed their diet or started growing or did something to supplement, right? So short of that, I just move on with my day, take care of my animals, make more plans, build more stuff, and plant more trees.
Gotcha. So look, here's the thing, though. There are a lot of people that are so invested in virtual stuff and things that, now, this always sounds, you know, counterintuitive when I discuss this on my show, because it's like, yeah, most of you are listening on smartphones and the internet and so on. But truthfully, most of that is going to wind up being toxic. Not my show, but just what you're engaged with. And so I always say, look, at the very least, unplug sometimes. Because people get so caught up in this, you know, virtual world, they forget to participate in the world around them.
Now, yes.
I brought that up with Corbett just really quickly, where it's like, they're going to argue about the ins and outs and the stocks and how this works. And it's $40 billion, which is an amount of money I can't even really truthfully fathom that somebody's going to pay to, you know, buy this thing. Okay, whatever. They're going to debate it. They're going to choose sides. Elon's a savior. Elon's a devil. So on and so forth. And meanwhile, they have no idea what is in the water that they're cooking their food in and taking showers in.
Right. Okay?
And they don't know what's...
Or completely oblivious to their suicidal neighbor, right, who's depressed, where, you know, if you were being a good neighbor and you did actually care about humanity, then what some rich character over there is spending their money on really shouldn't be your interest. Your interest should be getting out to see your neighbors and checking your own health and checking that, you know, making things better, like right here, right now. This whole internet world, I mean, it's cool. I'm glad it exists. Right. We wouldn't be able to be doing things like this and, you know, reach out to a lot of really great people that I've met all over the world throughout these years. But, you know, I think we need to find a limit. You said balance, tune out occasionally.
Sure.
Or like in my case, it was, I tuned out forever. And my mental health has only improved.
Right.
And in fact, I question if I would have been able to attempt to regain or gain or learn what actual sanity is if I was still in that chasing rabbit holes, fighting them, blaming everyone. And, you know, yeah, they do bad things, right? But we can spend our whole life looking at bad things that other people do, or we could nourish and enrich our own lives by doing good things and reversing that, right?
Right.
Well, is that crazy?
No, not at all. And here's the ultimate point in my mind, which is, you know, because people say, oh, because of the pandemic, everybody got all disconnected and whatnot. And I say, no, they didn't get disconnected because of the pandemic. The pandemic was an acceleration of what was already taking place, where people were disconnected from one another and they were not engaging in a real sense. And I noted this, you know, again on the show before the pandemic, where I was talking about constantly going out in public and seeing people have conversations that, as a listener, made zero sense. They were talking at each other everywhere I went. Nobody is listening to anybody else. And look, the gift of being able to verbalize is important, can convey so many things, can be healing in and of itself, whether you're the person who is verbalizing or you're the listener, okay? They can educate you in so many different ways, and people were disconnected from that very natural communication that they had with one another. They weren't engaged. They were separated from one another. And of course, now it's like, okay, old man, you just don't want to deal with the technology. At one, I'm 52. No, that's not the case. The thing is that there was a very unrealistic way of communication that was then exacerbated by the lockdowns and people being separate and now going to work via Zoom and so on and so on and so on. And this, in my mind, is at the core Now they're starting to acknowledge, you know, younger people are seemingly more depressed. Well, maybe that's because they're not interacting with one another as we used to. And I'm not saying that we didn't used to be depressed. And I'm not saying the generations before us didn't get down in the dumps. And I'm not saying... All I'm saying is they don't have the same experiential interaction with life that we used to have and that used to be normal one way or another. I know, right. You're not supposed to use the word normal, but I don't care. Thing is, it was normal. It was normal, whether for good or bad, right?
Right.
You might have gotten bullied sometimes. You might have gotten into fights. You might have argued over, if you're two girls, you'd be arguing over some dude, or two dudes arguing over some girl, or you might be arguing over territory one way or another. You know, this is my block. My friends hang out here. Whatever. Stupid things you were doing, you were still actually participating in life.
Right. Social skills. You know? Whether you're the bully or getting bullied, you know, eventually one of us, or most of us, are going to learn the dynamics of why that took place, right? And hopefully, if we are on a path of self-healing or self-reflection, then, you know, we're not going to be blaming ourselves or others. We're going to be figuring out how we can take responsibility to not land in those situations again, right? Mm-hmm. I'm glad you brought up the whole separation thing, though, because sometimes, I mean, well, Chuck, let me ask you this. Do you ever wonder if the whole, well, I'll just call it the 2020 thing, if it was just a big fat mirror reflection of how society was already operating and just like, here, I'm going to hold up the mirror and, you know, like the Illuminati or whatever, or aliens or whoever, whatever, sitting back. Do you think they're really going to fall for this if we really show them how anti-nature and anti-human they're already acting? Well, here, let's push a little further and see if they'll go along with this. I mean,
see, it's funny. I think you and I were talking back then in 2019, kind of often, and I kept saying to you, I believe that 2020 is literally going to be a time of clarity. And people got sick of me saying it, but I believed it. And you know what? I will pat myself on the back and say I was right. Because this clarified exactly what you're talking about. Society was already operating in its surrogate form, where you're not really interacting with somebody. You're using a proprietary system to interact one way or another. You're being positioned so that social distancing was kind of a norm then. They just didn't tell you it was 6 feet. Everybody stayed away from everybody else, and this seemed to be common in our society altogether. Okay? I think what happened is people's vision got a lot clearer on this. 2020, right, if you will. Something I have no realistic connection to. But, you know, because 2020, that's a dream I've never even had. But I understand what 2020 is. And, you know, visually, by the way, it's visual acuity. Most people don't even understand it. The fact is, it's like if an object is 20 feet away, it appears 20 feet away. You have clarity. That's what 2020 vision is. And I feel like that's exactly what we got if you had your eyes open in 2020. So,
and even people that didn't have their eyes open, they were forced to open in some cases. They're like, oh, wow.
Right.
Wait, what?
Exactly. I mean, you had to recognize certain things that were going on. Clarity was maybe thrust upon you, wasn't even necessarily a choice. And even for those that might say, well, I can't stand being around people and this and that anyway. Yeah, you know why you've gotten like that. You've been encouraged to be like that. And I get it. You think it's part of your natural way of being, but it really isn't. Okay, you might want to be selective about that. I'm not saying connect to everybody all the time.
Right.
But, you know, because some people are toxic, don't forget.
Less is more.
Less is more sometimes. But this is the thing. I think the lack of connectivity and an increasing encouragement to identify things as a disorder as opposed to just a bad patch in life is another problem. But let's not go there immediately. let's go to the unreal reality, because this is where I feel as though people have been encouraged to disconnect. They've been encouraged to isolate, not just because of a pandemic, but, you know, they've been encouraged to isolate anyway. It was already happening, like you said. And this is one of those things, sorry, but I've been reading psychological literature since I was, 9 years old. Gotta tell you, as somebody who isolates, okay, they never describe that as healthy. That's never been, you know, the inconsistencies and the weird thing that is psychology. Nobody ever says isolate yourself, okay, for long periods of time.
Prison camps or torture or Guantanamo, things like that wouldn't be a big deal, right? Because, it's just normal to isolate people.
Yeah. Well, there you have it. So this is a key, and this gets into not embracing the natural design again. So could you explain that to me in your way? How, basically, a lot of times I think depression, somebody who's, you know, down, kind of in a down slope sometimes, is simply not embracing their natural condition, their natural design. Part of it is connecting with other people, but there's more to it. So where should we begin on that now that I've already killed like 20 minutes of our time? Where should we begin?
I'm not sure if you heard Pluto in the background, but he seems to want to talk.
Yes, I'm hearing kitties. I don't know which kitties which, but I'm hearing kitties.
So Venus just had babies, and she's trying to hide them in the closet. And basically anybody that walks near my door or tries to go through it gets attacked. So he's on my bed protesting.
Yes, in the chat room, somebody said, I heard a cat. Yes, you did. It's not my cat. That's Christy's cat. Now, the puppy yelps, they might be mine. Go ahead, Christy. It's all you. Sorry.
So I just want to say, all right, and you're asking me my opinion. I just want, let this be stated, anything I say is my opinion based on my experience. It's not to, you know, I'm not trying to say other people's opinions or experiences are wrong.
Right.
But my opinion is that everything about government is, or believing in it, is a mental issue. And it clearly, that is all government promotes. And with their clear gaslighting techniques, you guys just talked about Stockholm Syndrome, which, I mean, is clearly prevalent in today's society. But I mean, government, come on, this is like first grade or elementary conspiracy or truth or talk, you know, govern,
right,
to control, mend the mind. It's, that's not going to change. And so my approach, and keep in mind, I was the exact opposite before than I am today, right? So this is what I've grown into. My approach today is not to engage with people who lie to me or people who try to control me. And it's, I just have this thing. I just, once you lie to me, in fact, I'm going through this right now with a mechanic that has my car, $1,700 in maintenance, and went to pick it up and he wouldn't accept my money. And like, after wasting all this time and multiple rides out there, I'm just like, I am done. And he has my car, you know what I mean? But I'm done, because you cannot engage with abusive, psychopathic, lying, manipulating control freaks for your mental health. It doesn't matter if they're called government or parents or children or brothers or sisters or friends or work co-workers or bosses. It doesn't matter what you call them.
Could be lovers, okay? Too. I mean, you know, some people are in these toxic relationships. Same thing is going on whether they recognize it or not. Somebody's lying to them and trying to control them at all times. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, somebody might not lie once in a while. Look, people are human. But, I mean, when you got a pattern of that,
right,
it doesn't matter. Okay, yeah.
So a little white lie or a lie based on fear, like I'm afraid to tell her or him this because they might judge me or whatever. I get that, okay? But again, when you realize that you're safe with that person, come clean and, you know, be honest and, you know, and that's a thing. And everyone is worthy and capable of redemption, right? And at least for me personally, I will forgive anyone that takes responsibility for their actions, right? We were all, and again, my former self, on pills, drinking alcohol, programmed by TV, media, politicians, right. Churches. I was not the epitome of health, right? Or a healthy state of mind. So I just think the better we get at saying no to psychopaths, the healthier we become, not only mentally, but also physically, because the physical is just a byproduct of our emotional / mental / spiritual state.
See, but there's a circular relationship there, because right. If your mind is not right, your body will not be right. But also, if your body's not right, it'll work on your mind and make that not right as well. So here's the thing. You got to take care of the whole thing. All right, you can't just, okay, I'm going to ignore the problems in my mind, in my heart, so to speak. I'm going to ignore those. I'm going to take care of my body. It's not going to work.
Right.
It's just not. You know, it's the guy who, oh, he was working out in the gym every single day, and he was doing just fine, and he dropped dead. Yeah, probably wasn't taking care of something. Either that or he had a vaccine, you know. But it's one of these things. You have to take care of the whole thing. So you have to be aware of the physical. You have to take care of the physical. That's a given. But you also must do self-care on the rest. And the beginning of it is exactly what you're saying. First problem is you don't add extra weight, extra stress, extra, well, disease, pressure. Okay? I can describe people in a lot of different ways. And a lot of that will come through people. Not, you know, your environment's one thing, the environment you're in, but also the living things you surround yourself with play a huge role here. So it almost sounds like I'm contradicting myself, right? People are too disconnected, but beware of being around certain people. I don't see a contradiction there. I think that there are people that, for one reason or another, are on a destructive path, and they usually want company, okay? On their destructive path. Now, you have choices. You, the individual, have choices. And this is a key element here to a lot of people. They eventually snap. They can't take it anymore. How many times have you heard that? I got stressed out. I did this. I've done it. I know, well.
Absolutely.
Not going to speak out of school, but Christy, I know you well enough to know that you've had a few.
I can rage. Yeah. I can scream. I can cry. I can cuss. I can, you know, say poor me and I'm never gonna make it. I have done and can do and may again do all of those things,
right?
Which, by the way, are totally normal when you're a human living on this earth, right? Now, to what degree we take these things and how far we let them control us, right? See, first thing we need to do is stop looking at depression or anxiety as a disease. It's a symptom of something else going on. So just as if I'm helping somebody, say, with heart disease or autoimmune or a damn so-called common cold or whatever, the treatment essentially is the same. You know, and you don't want to just block the symptoms, right, by taking mind-numbing pills. If you're feeling depression or anxiety and you're having physical symptoms due to it, that's your body screaming out. There is something going on. Look at me. Pay attention to me. You know, whatever this is. So we do, in a sense, Chuck, you're not contradicting yourself. There's such a thing as discernment. But we do have to take that time to go inward. And if we don't know what the triggers or what's causing the symptoms, depression / anxiety or anything else, that's where we may have to, say, isolate or spend time in solitude. And honestly, I would actually recommend nature or pets or massage or affirmative prayer or exercise or, you know, yoga or breathing or a hobby or something like that, right?
But well, they used to say to us all the time, right, you know, everything in moderation is okay. They were half right. Not everything in moderation is okay, but even isolation, again, sounds like I'm going to speak against what I said, but no, sometimes isolation is a good thing. Incrementally, you don't, you know, don't be a, being a hermit, I don't think is a good idea for most people. Okay, I really would never suggest that. Right.
We're social creatures.
Yeah, we're social creatures, so don't entirely and completely remove yourself from any interaction with other people for a long period of time.
Right.
Short
but
periods.
Here's where it's important.
But short
if
periods,
we,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So it is important at times to isolate yourself. For example, and I'm speaking from my own experience, okay? This is my own opinion. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychologist. Isolation for me in my healing time was essential for many reasons. Number one, in today's society, you're not allowed to talk about so-called negative feelings or depressive thoughts or, you know, things like that, right? Your parents don't want to hear it. Your friends don't want to hear it. Your church doesn't want to hear it. You know, your doctor will give you more pills, sure. But so if we're going to heal our trauma, right, which is the root of the symptoms that we're talking about today, we need to be in a safe place. Many of us do not have a safe place, safe people, safe whatever, right? And, you know, oh, well, I could tell my mom or my best friend, but if they're always telling you to go to the doctor and take a pill, they're not listening to you. So spending that time with yourself will help you sort out those thoughts without the energies of other things, people, entities around you, right? And also in my healing, like some things that were crucial and like rules that I literally made for myself long ago, of course, was the no politics and, you know, tune them all out and they don't exist anymore. But some of my other rules are, well, I guess I have a lot of rules. But, so if we're looking at...
It's okay. Go ahead.
If we're looking at our healing and taking it seriously, this alone time with ourselves is crucial because, one, we're safe to feel our thoughts without somebody trying to lock us up, right? Or scaring somebody else. Two, we're allowed to cry. We're allowed to scream. We're allowed to express every dark feeling, emotion we ever had. Like, you know, and misery loves company. You brought that up, the whole, people like to complain. And, you know, that's not a healing place to be, right? So if all of your friend circle is just about talking about your traumas or your targeting or your pain or, you know, my inflammation is bigger than yours or something, that's, you know, you're going to have to use some self-responsibility and try, if you want healing, to remove yourself from those situations, right? And so another one of my rules that I would do, especially like when I was trying to get my memory back, I mean, for those of you who don't know, 6 years ago today, I couldn't talk or walk. I didn't even know my name, my neighbors' names, my, you know what I'm saying? So, and I reminded myself how to heal by listening to my old shows, which, you know, a lot of those things didn't work because I was in a different classroom now and I had to get to the root, not just the best herb or the best juice or the best diet or all of this stuff, right? Because as you mentioned, it's a holistic, whole with a W, approach where you take everything into consideration. So, like, my rules, I wouldn't listen to other people's stories of trauma. I wouldn't read Kathy O'Brien or anything like that, because I wanted to make sure that my memories were my own and only mine. Because, number one, I already knew how easily programmable I was, right? When we all realize we've been mind controlled since birth, then we can start to heal it. So I knew that, holy crap, I'm susceptible to this through the media, the books, and I didn't want to listen to anything that would confuse me as to who I am or what I experienced. Or, and you get that a lot in support groups, like targeted individuals or things like that, political type persecution groups, some, you know, at least the ones that I used to know.
See, those are good for acknowledgement, those kind of groups, whether they're, and the people do this online now. It's good for acknowledgement because, you know, at a certain point you start to feel that you are special in that this is only affecting you. And what you can find out by interacting with other people is that it is not singular. It's not just you. You know what I mean? The world is against me. No, they're not. They're just not. And you may find there are other people who feel that way. And just finding that out is a good thing, I would say. Because literally, you know, you and I share something, right? And we'll tell each other, look, I had this problem. And you go, oh, my God, so did I. Now, that little bit of acknowledgement that we have between us, whatever it is, it could be very personal. It could be we just had a little thing right before going to air about car problems. It could be that. Okay, it could be anything. It's like, well, the fact that you don't feel alone in your struggle is good.
Right.
But what you don't want to do is sink into it and center your life on your pain. See, because if you do that, now your whole life is built around it. Now your whole interaction is built around it. Your whole socialization. Like, I saw this with people that went into AA. And I'm not saying don't use it if, you know, it works for you and it helps you get away from alcohol. Use whatever you can, okay? Yes. But when your whole life now is encompassed in that, and then you have a problem like you make a mistake, you take a drink, well, now you're invited out of the social circle that your entire life centers on. And this becomes a bigger problem than it was to start with. So you have to avoid making the symptom the center of your life. Would you agree with that?
100%, Chuck. Absolutely. So yeah, groups are good for one thing. And like, as you meant, like, you and I can talk and I have friends, we can talk. That's healthy, right? That's what I think I said this last week. We don't need to pay the rapist, I mean, therapist. We need good, honest friends. And we can, and never once in all the years I've known you, Chuck, have you ever dwelled on one issue and let it control your life. Like, we have a healthy exchange and share, oh, this happened, okay, oh, that sucks, oh, I'm sorry, you know, give you a hug, and then, like, all right, how do we pick up these pieces? And, you know, so, yeah, it's important to feel acknowledged and be understood and to realize you're not alone, but to center your life around it. I mean, really, we can all, I realized my entire life up until like a decade or so ago was built literally and based on trauma and decisions I made in that mindset, and was, I'm sure I mentioned last time, suicidal most of my life, okay? Depression, anxiety, all of that. So, you know, I know both sides. I definitely mired in misery for a really long time, not because it was particularly fun, but I didn't know another way. Trauma and things like this weren't openly talked about, right? Because it was only dudes coming back from war. And if you're in a family and, you know, being sold or raped or passed around or whatever, you know, you're just the troublemaking child, that, of course, needs to be medicated because, you know, you can't shame the family or what. You know, there's so many things. And, you know, like it or not, growing up in this world, we all have varying degrees of trauma. So are we going to let that rule our lives, or are we going to say thank you for this opportunity to make myself stronger and overcome this and find out what I'm really made of, right? And then make your traumas your superpower, because once you get a handle on them, right, and take responsibility for limiting triggers and things, then you're now able to help others, right? And hopefully they don't have to, you know, experience as dark as, you know, a lot of us have.
Right.
But maybe sometimes we all do, because how else are we really going to learn it, right? Sometimes the pain has to be so much, you know, before people want to change, that, you know, there's that comfort zone thing. And, you know, whether it's the miserable relationship for 20 or 30 years or the job, right, and, you know, you're holding on to it because of the prize or what society would think, or I have the only marriage in the family that didn't fail, or I have the best job my family ever had, or, you know, I make more money than all my friends, so I have to, you know, whatever the situation is with you, we really have to look at our choices, why we're making these choices, and if we aren't completely content with our circumstances, we have to be able to reflect on what we can do to actually know and believe that you do have the best life possible and you are content, right? Because isn't that what everybody wants? Everyone, you know, what do you want in life? Peace, love, and happiness. Everybody says that.
Right.
So what are you doing to create that?
Well, and here's the other thing. A stop sign for a lot of people is this, you know, you get trapped in, I'm just suffering. I'm suffering. I'm a victim. I'm in pain. All of this. And you and I, one of the earliest conversations where you and I got real with each other, I recall conversations like a nut, by the way. And
my homelessness, huh?
Back then, we were talking.
When I couldn't walk, and, oh, I'm sure it was dramatic.
You were just
putting up with me.
You were just getting there. You were just getting around to functional, and you were talking about how you were going to feed people out of the van and all that. And I said, yeah, okay, that's great and everything. And we started talking, and we were sharing a few things personal. And you said, you know, well, you know, you gotta work with the pain that you're in. You were trying to help me still. And I was like, please don't. I understand where I'm at. And I was going through something. It was a tough time, but you know where you were. So the thing is this, I said to you, I said, look, no matter what, I know this, that pain, that darkness, whether it's what you're going through or it's what I'm going through or what I've already been through in my life, I've been through it enough times to know this, that is the only way that real wisdom gets built, is through that. And so therefore, you don't get trapped in it. You're not supposed to remain in it. You don't hang out like, I'm going to take a college course in wisdom and be in misery for the next 4 years. No, that's not the point. But understand that it is part of the process. It's not where you have to stay ever. You can get out of it. Okay. It's not always the 1, 2, 3 quick, you know, I got an answer for you in 5 minutes. But one way or another, once you get through all that, your wisdom is built that way. And those of us that wish to serve others is exactly the type of tool that ends up in your box so you can do that work later. It's all good. It's not something you want to linger on. It's not something you want to remain in, but it is something that you want to embrace because it's going to give you that knowledge. How do you get out of that? Now you see somebody in not so dire a situation. They're in some darkness, but it isn't pitch black like you know. They're in some pain, but it's not the agony you know. But you know it enough to say, you know what? I got to a point of agony. I got to a point where the darkness was so thick I thought I could bite it. Okay, you know, you don't have to go there. You might be able to prevent somebody else by giving them a little bit of that wisdom that you earned.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
And that was one of the things that we were talking about. I forget which one of us said which part of it, but that's what we came together on. And it was after the horrible situation you had been through, and then you got sick again. And
I was in the hospital like 2 months after that.
Yeah. And I was a bit worried for you, and I wasn't really in contact with you, but it was like, wow, she's sick again. But here's what I knew. I knew I wasn't going to be talking about, you know, my dead friend Christy. I knew that wasn't going to happen because I knew you weren't going to give up that easy. So it's just that simple. And I'm not saying that other people get, you know, you get knocked down. There are times you're not going to maintain that. I'm going to be strong and I'm going to work through this. You know what? If you could maintain that 24 hours a day, please come and teach me, because there are going to be moments where you're going to go, nope, to hell with it. I give up. I don't want this. I can't do this. I get it. But again, you don't have to linger there. It doesn't have to stay that way. Express it. Purge it from yourself. Move on. And you can move on. I'm not saying you'll get over it. You know, like some people say, just get over it. No, no, no. I'm saying you can get over it, but the only way you're going to do that is to keep moving. Physically, yes, but mentally as well. Emotionally, keep it moving. It might not all be pleasant, but keep moving. That's how you know you're alive. Okay?
Right.
And so that has always remained with me, that conversation we had. And, of course, both of us had these ideas already, but we were able to share them. And so, therefore, here we are today. And that is the kind of thing that you can do.
I love it. Yeah. Thank you for the recollection. Yeah, that's awesome. And I want to say this about... you know, that I think it's funny that you mentioned, like, you're in the van and, you know, we're just barely starting to walk and talk again, and you're trying to help me and you're like, calm down, Christy, you know. But
right.
I just want to say that we, even when things are crappy, that's actually the best time to go out of your way and help other people. And yeah, even in my homelessness, I was still feeding other people or giving them stuff from my storage and doing what, you know, because I had a tuna can and alcohol. That was my stove. So right. I would literally cook meals, whether it's quesadillas, or sometimes I would get hired to cook fancy dinners for, you know, people with more money than me. And then they'd give me all the leftovers and I'd bring it all down there. And yeah, so helping people, like if you're in a really depressed state of mind, helping somebody else is, I think, one of the quickest ways to help you feel better.
Right.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I also, you mentioned, you know, giving up. And I want to say that when you reach that point that I've had enough and I give up, that's actually a really good place to be, because that probably means you reach the threshold of pain that you need to start making changes. And I actually did a video like 5 years ago called Giving Up on Life to Realize Your Dreams. And the premise behind that is really when we're in a traumatized state of mind, right? Or even say a low grade depression, not even clinical, but you know, that's pretty common and normal, right? Or just in that, you know, just getting by kind of constant dull state of life. Oh, crap. Now I was looking at the picture in my mind and trying to explain it. And now now I forgot where I was going with that.
No, it's okay. Even in a low...
Oh, the giving up part.
Yes.
Okay. So when we're in that, and like where I realized that my entire life was built and based on trauma, whatever dreams or ideas I had weren't even mine to begin with. they were programmed, right? And I thought that I liked Pepsi because my mom said Pepsi is better than Coke, right? Or because I watched more Coke commercials, or I thought I was choosing the best deodorant or the best food because I watched it replay on a commercial every day, right? Or I was told that, you know, you can only achieve this much. Or so all of my dreams at the time were limiting because I didn't know there was a grander picture outside that constant state of trauma. Unrecognized and undealt with trauma, might I add, right? So sometimes we literally do have to give up and surrender to that flow. And you know what? Make yourself comfortable. Make that your number one focus. And for me, I had to go to nature. It didn't matter, you know, people offered me their couches or this and that. Nope. I knew I had to stay in the van. I had to go to nature and just be inspired, literally, and be reminded that there's no way you can spend that kind of time in nature and not come out with a better understanding of life in general and how the world works or doesn't work, right? And if you're able to recognize what doesn't work, then it's your duty to yourself, your purpose, your path, your healing to go away from it. Even if you don't know what's on the other side or what right is. But if you know that everything you're currently surrounded by is wrong, believe it and change it. Whatever it takes, even if you have to live in a tent or a van or a storage unit or a moldy shed, even if you have to do that, because, yeah, that's traumatic as well.
Yes.
But as you were discussing wisdom, wisdom is just simply experienced knowledge.
Right.
So we can sit here and talk about this stuff till we're blue in the face like I used to. And Soul Journeys Radio and Truth Brigade and all of that stuff, right? But I didn't actually live those things, right? And even before my homelessness, I used to help homeless people, and I thought I knew what helping homeless people was, but no, I had to actually be homeless to really understand and know what helps homeless people or not, etc., and how to get out of it, right? So thankfully, as a result of my traumas, I have been able to help people get out of situations that they saw no end to, just like myself.
Right. And you know, look, some of these things come over time. I spent 10 years trying to be a rock star. Right? And I was after something that I thought I wanted. I didn't really want that. And it took my experience to get there. It's like, well, wait a minute, if you really thought, and I really did think at one time that that was the path I wanted, that that was the major life change I wanted. Frankly, even though it's trying sometimes, I am really happy doing a talk radio show. With the act of just doing the show, I'm extremely happy with that. It took me a long time.
And you're really great at it, too, Chuck.
Well, I appreciate that, but even if I wasn't, I'm happy doing it. You know, I don't know how good I am, but I just, it doesn't matter.
Just my opinion.
I'm able to do it, but I'm able to, and it is exactly what I should have been doing all along. And it took me until, you know, my 40th year to figure this out. Okay? Look, again, through my teenage years and into my 20s, I thought that's what I wanted. Then I just figured I needed a job. None of this stuff made me happy doing it.
Right.
None of it at all. And, you know, thought I wanted to form a family, which I did. I just chose the wrong woman to start with. But, you know, I wanted that, and I wanted this, exactly what I'm doing right now.
So I have a question for you, Chuck.
Yeah.
Because, like, for me, radio and all of this stuff happened because of trauma.
Yeah.
So for you, was your life path, did it go from rock star to radio? Was there some kind of trauma in between that guided you here?
Tons of it. And really...
Okay, so there you go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They're here to build us up. They're not here to break us down. They're here to teach us that experiential wisdom that you keep mentioning us to get us on the path, right? If we're depressed, we're not on our soul path, period. End of story.
That's
it. You know what? That's the time. Take your isolation, work out those deep pressed emotions, and get that deep rest in a comfortable, safe place, whether that's your own home or a trusted friend or whatever. But there's not one single person I've met that it wasn't a traumatic incident or a few that guided them to the path that they couldn't see before in the traumatized state of mind.
Right. And look, whenever it comes, it's supposed to come, by the way, because I should have realized this so much earlier in my life. I was a little kid right after my father died. You know, I was lonely, and it was the talk radio that kept me company.
Right.
And I loved it and understood it and appreciated it. And I should have just realized that. I kept it with me my whole life. Always listened to. I mean, I was a regular listener of all kinds of different personalities, formats, everything. Talk radio made the most sense to me out of anything, and it was right in front of me all the time. And I didn't say, I should just go do this. I didn't do that until way later. And, you know, broken hearts and broken plans and lots of pain, and I ended up homeless at a certain point and all kinds of things. And eventually I got to, you know what, I need to just do this. And the act of doing it in and of itself is exactly what I'm supposed to do. Sometimes I don't know much else but that anymore. But honestly, it's the only time that I get to do what it is I need to do. And everything else I do in my life, actually, it's funny, centering something on you know something that you enjoy, centering your life on that is not a bad thing, even though it does take some work, and I had to learn a lot of things and get over some hurdles that maybe some other people don't have to get over to do it.
Right.
You know, it doesn't matter. I got there and I'm doing it.
But you're just further proof that, I mean, people let their which I call them diff abilities, but they let their so-called disabilities rule their life. Well, for example, I'm blind. I could never sit on a computer and do radio and run my own station and engineer, you know, all the things you have, right? And that's simply not true. Mm-hmm. You're living proof that anyone that where there's a will, there's a way. And I do believe that we can overcome anything. We just have to find that different ability, right? Right. And I also may be unpopular, but I believe that these conditions kind of help bring out our superpower, right? So if we're, say, maybe your physical eyes, I'm just hypothetically speaking, maybe if they don't work at optimal level, maybe your third eye or other senses are yep. pretty high off the charts, right, to make up for that. I don't believe that there's a soul that's incapable of, like, the same amount of greatness as anyone else.
Well, there's a constant, you know, refrain in military circles, and certain ones especially, which is effective for a reason. You adapt, you overcome. You adapt, you overcome. That's it. That's all there is to it. And look, whether it's a seemingly crippling emotional condition, a physical condition, you adapt, you overcome, and at all times there are opportunities to heal. And you can learn about that at mytrueessence.net. You can
There's
learn about
no
that.
There's no way an hour went by already.
It did.
There's no way.
It did. We're actually just slightly over the hour. ChristyAphrodite.com as well. And we're going to keep doing this every Tuesday. we started with depression and got into, well, how do you conquer a lot of things?
It's all the same thing.
Yeah. Funny thing about that, it seems to rhyme, as they used to say, right? History doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. And so do your traumas, and so do the solutions. You will find them if you seek them. ChristyAphrodite.com, MyTrueEssence.net. The Ocelli Effect is done for tonight. No matter who you are, where you are, when you are, remember, I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.